From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
Our next guest, Dr. Danielle Dick, says genetics affects every single aspect of our human behavior, and each child is uniquely coded with predispositions that influence everything from the fearfulness to impulsivity to their propensity to throw huge fits at the grocery store. We all want to know what determines that. Danielle Dick is an internationally recognized and award-winning expert on genetic and environmental influences on human behavior. She joins us to discuss her new book on the topic, in which she helps us to understand our child's unique nature so we can achieve happier, more effective parenting and life. The book is called The Child's Code. Dr. Danielle Dick, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. This topic of genetic coding for behavior is, I think, relatively new to the popular conversation, but it's been around for a while, since the late 90s. Could you give us a little bit of a kind of history on what's going on in this field?
Absolutely. So I'm a researcher who has been working in this area for 20-plus years, and there is absolutely compelling, unambiguous evidence that genetics influences virtually all aspects of human behavior. So when we think about all the things that make us different, from impulsivity to anxiety to life satisfaction, that about half of the differences between us is due to differences in our DNA, and about half is due to differences in our environments. And that's true of our kids, too. So child behavior is strongly influenced in part by their genetics. But when I became a parent, I realized that that fundamental biological fact, which is so accepted in science, hadn't made its way into mainstream parenting. And that was really leading to parents putting a lot of pressure and worry that's not necessary on themselves. And that was the background behind what led me to write this book.
Well, it's completely liberating now that I hear this, because, you know, I've had those moments at the grocery store, especially my wife has, where we've had a child throwing a temper tantrum and, you know, clearing the shelves of whatever they didn't like, and embarrassing ourselves at the grocery store. And so we can literally just step away and say, hey, it's nature. We have nothing to do with this, right?
So I have been there too. I have had that child in the grocery store. You know, many of us have. And you're absolutely right that we often put too much pressure on ourselves. And candidly, if we're honest, we're often kind of judgy about other parents too, right? We see the child throwing a fit and we think that parent needs to, you know, insert your favorite parenting advice here. But the reality is that our kids differ tremendously in a variety of temperamental dimensions, but one of the big three that I talk about in the book is emotionality. And some kids are simply more predisposed toward frustration and fear and distress. So when something doesn't go their way, you know, you tell them they can't get the Lucky Charms at the grocery store, that just sends them over the edge because they're so upset about it, whereas another child might just be more go with the flow. And so, you know, oftentimes what happens is when we see that behavior in our kids, and emotionality is a great example, because we tend to go, oh, this is not okay. You can't clear all the cereal boxes off the aisle when you don't get what you want. And we double down on consequences. And if you think about that, what we're actually doing is our child who is prone to distress and frustration, we are now implementing something that will make them more distressed and frustrated. So our kind of natural, you know, go-to parenting techniques don't necessarily work for that particular child. And it turns out that there's actually parenting strategies that are far more effective for helping children who are naturally predisposed toward that high emotionality learn to control those feelings so that you will reduce the likelihood of the future temper tantrums in the grocery store.
I guess that's why no one parenting book is going to be, one size fits all for anyone. I mean, I have two kids. One came into the world screaming and, continued that way, very passionate, very emotional. And then the other came in very mellow, and I sort of wondered when he was going to cry. I wanted to ask you about, you bring up some really interesting studies. I think they call them adoption studies. One about schizophrenic mothers that was done in the 1960s and kids that were adopted out. What can you tell us about that? Because I think it's really interesting, again, going back to the nature-nurture conversation.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, to pick up on your first point, it's a running joke in our field that everyone is an environmentalist until they have their second child. And then you go, I'm doing the same things, but this child is responding totally differently. What's going on here? Yeah. And, I find that's sometimes the most salient thing for parents in terms of understanding, oh, yes, their genes are powerful stuff. But from a research perspective, there's actually a few different study designs that have all led us to the same conclusions about how important genes are. Not the only thing, but it's not just all environment. And you mentioned one of them, which is adoption studies, which is essentially that we can follow and study children who are adopted into families with whom they don't share genes, so with non-biological relatives. And it provides a really interesting natural experiment in the sense that you can have children who are being raised by their raised by people with whom they don't share genes. So they share environments, but not genes. And you can look and see how similar are those children to their adoptive parents with whom they share environments, and how similar are they to their biological parents with whom they share genes but no environment, assuming they're adopted away at a young age and don't have ongoing contact. And so, as you mentioned, that was a really pivotal way for realizing how important genes were in a variety of mental health conditions. And so it used to be thought, for example, that schizophrenia, a very severe psychiatric condition characterized by hallucinations and delusions, was caused by bad mothers, essentially. Moms get blamed for everything, right? It was thought that cold mothering contributed to this really debilitating condition in children. And, I think back to what that must have been like as a mother to watch your child struggling and then be told it was your fault. But in fact, what they found through adoption designs is that children who were adopted away from that biological parent who might have had schizophrenia, that those children raised by adoptive parents, they had the same rates of developing schizophrenia as children who were raised by a parent who was schizophrenic and with whom they shared genes. So in other words, moving them to a different environment, it wasn't like if you had a, quote, better parent or a better mother, you were any less likely to develop that disorder. And that really showed, wow, schizophrenia is actually a very heritable condition, that it's largely genes here influencing this outcome.
Oh, fascinating study. And then you do a study in Sweden, and I didn't know this, but there is just a lot more information kept on the registries of adopted kids. And you talk of, this one is about criminal behavior. So how heritable is that?
Yes, absolutely. And so you can do a lot of really interesting things in countries where there are these big national registries. In the book, I talk about these adoption studies in Sweden carried out by some of my colleagues. We also run big twin studies in Finland where we can find all the twins born in the country. And essentially, what we're looking at in adoption studies is how similar are kids to adoptive parents and how similar are they to biological parents as an index of you've separated out people with whom you share genes but no environment, and people with whom you share environment but no genes. And when it comes to something like, are you going to show up in the criminal registry, it turns out if you had a biological parent, even if you weren't raised by them, who showed up in the criminal registry, those kids had a higher likelihood. And that's probably because things like aggression are genetically influenced, and things like impulsivity or self-control are genetically influenced. And when you're not as good at thinking through consequences, you might be more likely to get yourself in circumstances where you're more likely to get in trouble. But the interesting thing is they also found that when adoptive parents were in the criminal registry, that those children also had an elevated rate. So in this case, it was really compelling evidence for it's both genes and it's also environment. And that, of course, is true for virtually all the behaviors that we're interested in as parents, these kind of behaviors that you see in all kids, and they vary across the spectrum. That part of it is their genes, but as parents, we can also do things to help play up their strengths and to help reduce potential challenges that they might be more predisposed to.
That's wonderful insight. I'm connecting this to another book I read called Quiet, and you also mentioned factors, these three factors, extroversion, emotionality, and effort. And I'm thinking of this propensity of many cultures to have more introverted interactions and personality types, and Western cultures to have more focus on extroversion. Are you seeing, or are you suggesting, that these cultural propensities or commonalities are also genetically, or is there, like you're suggesting, a balance of nurture and nature?
So extroversion is a great example of how understanding where your child falls can also help you figure out how you might be able to work with the environment to find a good fit for your child. And so by that I mean, you know, as adults, we talk a lot about extroversion. You know, if you ask someone, are you an extrovert, an introvert, or somewhere in between, they could probably give you a quick answer. And the idea of an introvert having to spend their Friday night at, you know, a cocktail party making small talk with lots of people they barely know is probably enough to make them want to cringe. Whereas for an extrovert, that sounds like a perfect way to spend a Friday night. Well, kids show preferences for being in busy social settings and being around lots of people versus needing more quiet time alone to recharge, and preferring to have quieter activities and a few close people in their lives from a very early age. And if you and your child are matched on that dimension, you might naturally be setting up environments and planning activities that are a good fit for your child because it's the things that you also think would be fun. But when there's a mismatch, and I'll give the example of my son and I are mismatched, and I am much more of the extrovert, and I would plan Saturday morning fun for us, where we would be meeting up with other friends, my friends, their toddler friends. We'd be going to, you know, the children's museum and a festival. And you naturally assume that other people's brains are going to work the way that yours works. And it turns out that on those Saturday mornings, I thought it was going to be tons of fun and we'd be heading out the door and I'd say, guess what? We're going to go to the children's festival and we're meeting up with, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so. And my child would just throw a massive fit. The shoes would come off. They'd be thrown against the wall. And, you know, as a parent, you're thinking, what had just happened? Well, what I figured out from essentially getting to know my child is, well, he's much more introverted. So to him, that sounded like torture, not like a fun Saturday morning together. And it was leading to this acting out behavior because his little toddler mind wasn't mature enough to say, Mom, that sounds very overwhelming to me. Could we instead do a play date with like one close friend? And so that's a way that by understanding how your child is wired, you can essentially reduce some of the tension that might exist in your household that you might not even be aware that that's where it's coming from.
And I'm sure none of our listeners are thinking, well, I've had that situation when I'm trying to take my kid mountain biking or for a wonderful hike. I don't understand why they wouldn't want to join us. And you give us, you know, some reflection to take a moment to think about how to have that conversation without just going in and yelling at our kids. But my other curiosity is there the possibility that maybe they could be just wanting to stay home and watch TV versus, you know, maybe their personality preference? And how do we differentiate those two?
Of course. And one of the reasons that I have sort of the quizzes for you to figure out where your child falls is because things that are actually more temperament, more personality, more kind of, you know, our hardwired tendencies, those are things that tend to be stable across time and across situations. So as parents, you know, we're usually the best ones to figure out, like, okay, do they usually like being out and about and doing sports, and now they're just throwing a fit today, and if so, something else might be going on? Or is it the case that, like in my case, every Saturday morning we were running into the same problem, in which case you might step back and reevaluate? And I also don't mean to suggest that we need to, you know, reorder our world and our environments to, you know, focus around our children, but what it can do is it can help us at least anticipate when there might be a mismatch. And so then we can do some more preparation with our kids instead of just springing it upon them.
A great point that you make. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is Dr. Danielle Dick. Her new book is The Child Code, Understanding Your Child's Unique Nature for Happier, More Effective Parenting. And I just wanted to make the point about introversion and extroversion, or actually you make the point in the book that we oftentimes, you know, we only assign introversion or extroversion to adults, and we have really overlooked children. And I wonder if during COVID we've had those introverted kids have so much more success in their lives and the extroverted kids being the ones who suffer the most.
You know, that's such a great point. You know, we see a lot in the news about how there have been increases in anxiety and mental health challenges and whatnot. But in all of our studies, actually what we find is a tremendous amount of variability in people's response to the pandemic. And that is based in large part on these individual differences. So we actually find that some people report that their mental health is better and report positive changes associated with the pandemic. Some report worsening, and many people kind of fall somewhere in the middle. And you are absolutely right that for many people that are more introverted, some of the reduced pressure of being out and about and around lots of people and doing lots of things has actually been relieving, and they've enjoyed that. And it is our more extroverted kids who have been more cooped up and who might have lost those social interactions and being around lots of children who have struggled more. And I think that by understanding that about your child, then you can also find alternate ways to meet those needs, meaning as we reemerge from, of course, we're still in the middle of the pandemic, but as, for example, many kids are going back to school for the first time in a year plus, kids who are more introverted may need, you know, more help and more support reintegrating into those settings. And it's also important to talk to teachers about kids' dispositional styles so that they understand the behavior that they might be seeing in the classroom. And conversely, when we are back in quarantine from time to time, kids who are more extroverted, we might need to be more intentional about finding ways to ensure that their needs are being met, whether it's through masked interactions or having a small pod or through Zoom play dates or other creative ways. Because when kids are being pushed into settings that are outside of their comfort zones and sort of their natural dispositional styles, that's what can create some of the tension and problems at home, because it spills out into other behaviors, being more irritable, being more quick to throw temper tantrums at the dinner table, etc.
Danielle, I want to get into your last part, which is the F factor, effort, fall, control, or effort. And we just have a few minutes left. So could you introduce this by talking to us about the marshmallow test in preschools, I believe, back in the 1960s, and how that carried out into the lives of those children?
Yes, absolutely. So many people have heard of the marshmallow test, which was the idea that they took a bunch of young children and you had to sit staring at a tempting treat, a marshmallow, a cookie, or some other sweet that the child had picked. And if you could wait 15 minutes without eating it, you got double the reward. You got a second one. And so really what it was evaluating is kids' ability to delay gratification, right, to impulse control. And what they found is that kids differed a ton, and there's actually a lot of hilarious videos you can find on YouTube of kids who are trying to hold out. And the most interesting part, though, is that they followed those children across time, and they found that differences in impulsivity and self-control, or what I like to call effortful control, to remind us that it takes effort to not do what we want when we want all the time. And those differences were fairly stable across time, and they were related to many differences in the kids' life outcomes. So they were related to differences in their academic outcomes, in their rates of developing substance use disorders, in their employment outcomes. And really what this shows us is how important this ability to delay gratification, right, to think through the long-term consequences of our actions is for so many areas of our lives. And the reality is that, well, all kids start pretty low. Bad news for us parents. The good news is that as our brains develop, they all get better at it. But some kids are just, it's naturally harder for them. They are naturally more impulsive. But the good news is that there's strategies that as parents we can put in place to really help them with that.
I always wonder about those, the differences in people who can stay away from a candy dish even though it's full of peanut M&Ms. They may have one every other day, or the people like Pete
have 10
and me, we just eat them all.
Yes.
Yes. I kid around that I can't keep potato chips in my house because I cannot open the bag and not eat the entire thing. So, you know, we implement strategies. I don't buy potato chips anymore. I know this about myself. This is a self-control strategy. And there's things that we can do with our kids as well. And, you know, one of the really important things to remember about effortful control is that, you know, and all of these dimensions I should mention, is that they aren't necessarily good or bad. There aren't dispositions that are good and dispositions that are bad. There's dispositional styles that create different types of challenges, and those can also change at different stages in a child's life. And so individuals who are higher on risk-taking, well, if you have a child who's like that, it can lead to a lot of trips to the ER and a lot of, you know, concerned parents as your child is dangling from the top of the monkey bars and those sorts of things. But risk-taking in adulthood, it turns out that CEOs and entrepreneurs are actually higher on risk-taking. Risk-taking can also lead to some challenging behaviors, right, like increased substance use. And so these aren't good or bad things, but by understanding our dispositional styles and our kids' dispositional styles, we can help them grow and develop into the best version of themselves.
What do we do when our kids are smarter than the person who's assessing them and they go, I don't want the cookie, but if you put down a $10 bill, you can double that if I stare at it for 15 minutes?
Yes, I too have a child who is always coming up with logic and arguments that he wants to discuss with me. And I remind myself that sometimes the most challenging children make the most interesting adults. So if you have one of those highly spirited, challenging children, then you too can adopt that as your mantra.
Well, it's been a true pleasure to have you, Dr. Danielle Dick, on our show. The book is called The Child Code, Understanding Your Child's Unique Nature for Happier and More Effective Parenting. All of us in our community are going to be jumping online and buying the book and making this community a better community. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Light.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.